Plato is very clear. And quit trying to make him rational by finding a more rational location than something, a great island, giant island, just outside the Pillars of Hercules or outside Gibraltar in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, where the Azores and the Canaries now rise up as small islands. This priest in Egypt, in the story being told by Plato, clearly defines a giant island bigger than North Africa and the Palestinian area combined in Egypt, just outside the Straits of Gibraltar, and beyond that island, other islands, plural, and beyond those other islands, continents that rim the Atlantic Ocean. Obviously, North and South America. There was passage for the seafarers of those times to the other islands, and from the islands to all the opposite continent which bounds that ocean truly named. For these regions that lie within the strait aforesaid seem to be but a bay having a narrow entrance. But the other is ocean verily. And the land surrounding it may with fullest truth and fitness be named a continent. In short, the islands of the Mediterranean are peanuts by comparison to what he's saying. Particularly the islands around Greece. In this island, Atlantis, arose a great and marvelous might of kings, ruling over all the island itself and many other islands, and parts of the mainland, and besides these of the lands east of the strait. They governed Libya as far as Egypt, and Europe to the borders of Etruria. So all this power gathered itself together, and your country and ours, and the whole region within the strait, it sought with one single swoop to enslave. Then, O Solon, did the power of your city shine forth in all men's eyes, glorious in valor and strength. For being foremost upon earth in courage and the arts of war, sometimes she was leader of the Hellenes, sometimes she stood alone for force when the rest fell away from her. And after being brought into the uttermost perils, she vanquished the invaders and triumphed over them. Invaders from Atlantis, no less. And the nations that were not yet enslaved, she preserved from slavery, while the rest of us who dwell this side the Pillars of Hercules, all did she set free with ungrudging hand. But in later time, after there had been exceeding great earthquakes and floods, there fell one day and night of destruction, and the warriors in your land, all in one body, were swallowed up by the earth. And in like manner did the island Atlantis sink beneath the sea and vanish away. Wherefore to this day, the ocean there is impassable and unsearchable, being blocked by various shallow shoals, which the island caused as she settled down. You have heard this brief statement, Socrates, of what the ancient Critias reported that he heard from Solon. And when you were speaking yesterday about the constitution and the men whom you described, I was amazed as I called to mind the story I've just told you, remarking how by some miraculous coincidence, most of your account agreed unerringly with the description of Solon. I was unwilling, however, to say anything at the moment, for after so long a time my memory was at fault. I conceived, therefore, that I must not speak until I had thoroughly gone over the whole story by myself, Accordingly, I was quick to accept the task you imposed on us yesterday, thinking that for the most arduous part of all such undertakings, I mean supplying a story fitly corresponding to our intentions, we should be fairly well provided. So then, as Hermocrates said, as soon as ever I departed hence yesterday, I began to repeat the legend to our friends as I remembered it, and when I got home I recovered nearly the whole of it by thinking it over at night. How true is the saying that what we learn in childhood has a wonderful hold on the memory. Of what I heard yesterday, I know not if I could call to mind the whole, but though it is so very long since I heard this tale, I should be surprised if a single point in it has escaped me. It was with much boyish delight that I listened at the time, and the old man was glad to instruct me, for I asked a great many questions, so that it is indelibly fixed in my mind, like those encaustic pictures which cannot be effaced. And I narrated the story to the rest the first thing in the morning, that they might share my affluence of words. Now, therefore, to return to the object of all our conversation, I am ready to speak, Socrates, not only in general terms, but entering into details as I heard it. The citizens and the city which you yesterday described to us as in a fable, we will transfer to the sphere of reality and to our own country, and we will suppose that ancient Athens is your ideal commonwealth, and say that the citizens whom you imagined are those veritable forefathers of ours of whom the priest spoke. They will fit exactly, and there will be nothing discordant in saying that they were the men who lived in those days. And dividing the work between us, we will all endeavor to render an appropriate fulfillment of your injunctions. So you must consider, Socrates, whether this story of ours satisfies you, or whether we must look for another in its stead. Socrates, how could we change it for the better, Croesus? It is specially appropriate to this festival of the goddess, owing to its connection with her, while the fact that it is no fictitious tale, but a true history, is surely a great point. How shall we find other such citizens if we relinquish these? It cannot be. So with fortune's favor, do you speak on, while I, in requital for my discourse of yesterday, have in my turn the privilege of listening in silence. So for the Timaeus. The next passage in Plato's works, which has reference to Atlantis, is his Croesus, which purports to be an account by a person of that name of the circumstances of life in Atlantis, as recounted by Solon to Dropidas, the speaker's great-grandfather. 9,000 years before Solon's day, or about 9600 B.C., war broke out between the nations within the Pillars of Hercules and those beyond them. Athens placed herself at the head of the eastern peoples, and the kings of the Isle of Atlantis led the western races. Atlantis was an isle greater than Asia Minor and Libya or North Africa together, but it was swallowed up by a convulsion of the earth, and its side is now marked by dangerous quicksands that render the sea routes in that region unnavigable. At this early period, Athens was possessed of extensive territories. Her lands were fertile and her inhabitants numerous. As regards the Atlanteans, Croesus explains to his hearers that he must render the names of their heroes into Greek. Solon, who had written an account of their history in verse, found that the priests of Sais had already given these names an Egyptian aspect. He would thus take a similar liberty, but would retain their significance. His ancestor had possessed an account of these things in writing, but he, Croesus, was compelled to rely on his memory for the facts which he had heard in childhood and which had deeply impressed themselves on his mind. The gods divided the earth into portions, both great and small, and to Poseidon or Neptune, god of the sea, had been awarded the Isle of Atlantis. where he begat children by a mortal woman. The island, which was not mountainous, near the seacoast, had in its midst a plain, which is said to have had no equal for beauty and fertility. About 6 miles from this plain stood a low mountain, where dwelt an aboriginal inhabitant, an autochthony called Evenor, who by his wife, Lucithi, had a daughter called Cleito. This girl, after the death of her parents, was espoused by Poseidon, who environed the mountain with mounds and ditches. The mounds were two in number, and the three ditches, which were filled with water from the sea, were placed at an equal distance one from the other, and rendered access to the mount impossible. Poseidon also set in the island two currents of water, one hot, the other cold, which assisted its fertilization exceedingly. The god reared in this enchanted place 5 pairs of male children, twins, of whom he was the father. He divided Atlantis into 10 parts. He bestowed on his eldest born the maternal domain, which was the largest and best situated, and established the remaining princes in the other regions of Atlantis as chiefs of different nations. The name of the eldest son was Atlas, who was the king of the entire island, and from him the Atlantic Ocean takes its name. His twin brother was called in the Atlantean language Gadir, and in the Greek Eumolus. He had for his portion the extremity of the island near the Pillars of Hercules, and that part of it has since borne the name Gadiric. The next pair of twins were called Amphises and Eudemon, and the others respectively Meneceus, Autochthonus, Elasippus, Nestor, Azaes, and Diaprepus. These princes reigned in prosperity in the island for several centuries and established a supremacy in the midst of the ocean over many other islands, as well as over those which are near Egypt and Tyrrhenia. The posterity of Atlas, the eldest and king, the posterity of Atlas maintained the sovereign power during several centuries in uninterrupted succession. Their riches were so great that they surpassed those of the kings who lived in the centuries preceding their own. And no monarch of the succeeding ages could in this respect compare with them. You say, well, you know, I'm lost already because some god, at least some person supernatural in relationship to man, is wed to some woman of mankind and bears children of obvious unusual abilities. Doesn't the Bible say the sons of God were attracted to the daughters of men and wed them and produced giants? Now that's the best King James can give to the translation of Nephilim. Doesn't necessarily mean giants in size, though it could mean that. Just as accurately means a general superiority. The posterity of Atlas maintained the sovereign power during several centuries in uninterrupted succession. Their riches were so great that they surpassed those of the kings who lived in the centuries preceding their own. And no monarch of the succeeding ages could in this respect compare with them. You say, well, I know all about gods and angels and demons. Well, do you really? Now, it seems rather strange to me that there are only these supernatural sons of God with the capacity to copulate with women. We hear about that. Now, if you had supernatural male beings with that sexual capacity, which the Bible claims, maybe there are some supernatural female beings you haven't heard about. And since women always want to take over, and since I believe they are superior creatures, I really believe that. I'll look you right in the eye and tell you that. The female gender is superior, with the exception of God, if he is male. He somehow managed to stay on top. Now, how do you know that we have the only record of some supernatural... Oh, you're not interested in that. San Francisco, why would Jesus call God Father if he was a woman? I never said he was a woman. Did I say he was a woman? I wouldn't admit it if he was. San Jose, Dr. Scott, I'm new to your program, and I'd like to hear your answer. A lot of people would on a lot of things that aren't new to the program. I'm a newly converted Muslim and would like to know, was Jesus a prophet or was he more than that? More than that. I'm confused. Well, not now. Thank you. You're welcome. I'm reading from The History of Atlantis by Lewis Spence. As I said, you can fill a library with books about Atlantis. Each of them have their own contribution. This particular book, and the reason I pulled it out of my library tonight, it has a compilation from many translations of Plato's two principal works that deal with Atlantis. And from those translations, this compilation puts together the coherent, combined story in ordinary language, and yet it's pristinely accurate. And I'm reading that story. We finished the Timaeus portion, and we're reading from Croesus, that portion of the story where the gods divided the earth into portions, great and small, and to Poseidon or Neptune, you say, well, I'm already tuned out because you say gods. Well, wait a minute, I didn't say gods. The story did, but so is Genesis. Like it or lump it, Genesis reads, in the beginning, Elohim, not El, doesn't say in the beginning, El, God Almighty, created the heavens and the earth, which is the singular form, but Elohim, which is the plural form. In the beginning, gods. That's what it says. King James can take all the liberty it wants and say, in the beginning, God. But that is not what the original says. And with the luxury of church councils that define the Trinity, you can stamp backward that meaning on it. It is still God's. That's what it says. Now, they could have been precise and said, in the beginning, 3 and 1. But that's what it says. It says, in the beginning, Elohim, plural, created the heavens, plural. That's consistent with the New Testament. Paul was transported, he didn't know whether in the body or out of it, he says, into the third heaven. In the beginning, gods created the heavens and the earth. This story, it says, the gods divided the earth into portions, both great and small, and to Poseidon or Neptune, god of the sea, had been awarded the Isle of Atlantis, where he begat children by a mortal woman. Atlas, his eldest son, was given the prime portion. And now I'm to where I left off. The posterity of Atlas maintained the sovereign power. And this is after having described a great island west of the Straits of Gibraltar, larger than northern Africa and the Palestinian area included, combined, with islands beyond it in the Atlantic Ocean, and a continent that rimmed that ocean past the islands, which in one terrible day of destruction, he says, sank beneath the sea. Now, in this Crucius portion of Plato's writings, he is telling the posterity of Atlantis, or Atlas rather, maintained the sovereign power during several centuries in uninterrupted succession. And as I was saying at the close of the half hour, we know about male supernatural beings who mated with the women on this earth. We don't know about female supernatural beings that may have pre-existed as the counterpart to these male supernatural beings. If such existed, we'd have goddesses. And if they got out of line and got banished somewhere or wiped out, you can understand why these male counterparts had unrequited urges. Just a little speculation, folks. God's known performance, that which we have a record of, shows a proneness to not create things by halves alone. Else why did he say concerning Adam? Not good for him to be alone. And he created, whoa, man. Well, let's keep reading. The posterity of Atlas maintained the sovereign power during several centuries in uninterrupted succession. I warn you, their riches were so great that they surpassed those of the kings who lived in the centuries preceding their own, and no monarch of the succeeding ages could in this respect compare with them. By their wise industry, they filled the capital city and the country with everything that was useful and agreeable to existence. Their power procured them all the productions of foreign lands. Their island furnished them with all kinds of stones and minerals, and above all with that mineral known as orichalcum, the most precious next to gold of all the metals. The island also produced in abundance all kinds of timber suitable for building construction. It nourished numerous herds of animals, both domestic and wild, and large numbers of elephants. These found plenty of food in the marshes, lakes, and rivers, in the plains and the mountains. The soil also produced a wealth of roots, wood, gums, flowers, and fruits, the sweet juice of the grape, and corn, all desirable viands and vegetables in their season. Shady trees sheltered its happy people, and divers fruits appeased their hunger and thirst, especially one with a hard rind, affording both meat, drink, and ointment. In a word, there was to be found in this island, which has so unhappily disappeared, everything which could satisfy the body, the spirit, and engender piety toward the gods. By means of these natural riches, the Atlanteans built temples, palaces, bridges, directing the waters, which flowed in a triple circle around their ancient metropolis in a useful manner. They began by constructing bridges over the zones of sea and another leading to the royal palace. They greatly increased this building in size and beauty with each successive reign and drove a canal through the zones of land 300 feet in width, about 100 feet deep, and about 60 miles in length. Interesting dimensions, by the way. At the landward end of this waterway, which was capable of navigation by the largest vessels, they constructed a harbor. The two zones of land were cut by large canals by which a trireme or three-decked galley was able to pass from one sea zone to another. The bridges by means of which communication was had between the land zones were sufficiently high to permit the passage of vessels, and these were roofed over. The first sea zone was about 1,800 feet wide, the second about 1,200 feet, and the third, which immediately encircled the island, was about 600 feet in width. Interesting dimensions. The diameter of the island on which the palace stood was 5 stadia, or about 1,000 yards. The isle and each zone were enclosed by stone walls. At the entrance to the bridges were gates surmounted by defending towers. The bridge at the principal entrance was about 100 feet wide. The stone of which these immense piles were constructed was quarried from the island and was black and black and red in color. The walls which encircled the outward zone were covered with a light coating of brass. Those of the interior had plates of tin, and the walls of the citadel were coated with orichalcum, second only to gold in value. The palace within the citadel was planned as follows. In the middle and most inaccessible part was the temple of Cleito and Poseidon, glittering with gold. Here the descendants of the first Atlanteans gathered each year to offer pious sacrifices to the gods. The temple of Poseidon was about 600 feet in length, 3 acres square, and of a height proportionate to its length and breadth. But its architecture was barbaric. The whole of its exterior was garnished with silver, its pinnacles glittered with gold, and the interior was roofed with ivory, gold, silver, and the flashing orichalcum. But orichalcum prevailed on the decoration of the interior walls, panels, and statues, although there were also statues of the purest gold. Poseidon was here represented standing in his chariot, grasping the reins of winged coursers. Around him were grouped 100 nereids born by dolphins, and other contiguous sculptures represented the princesses and princes of the royal line, and other effigies or votive gifts of the kings and people of the Atlantean Empire. The sacrificial altar, by its grandeur and beauty, was worthy of the magnificence of the temple, as indeed was the remainder of the royal edifices. In various parts of the city were situated hot springs and fountains of cold water, both of which flowed in abundance. Great baths were constructed, some open, others walled and roofed in, as hot baths for use in winter are. These were baths for the royal family. Others were reserved for women. And even horses and other domestic animals had bathing pools of their own. Kenny Rogers' house was especially significant. Each bath was constructed with due regard to decency and the convenience of the several classes which it served. Each of the two zones of the city was filled with temples, shrines, groves, and gymnasiums. Near the midst of the central island stood a large circular hippodrome, 600 feet in diameter. Round this hippodrome were arranged the dwellings of the court officials and guards. The soldiers of the royal guard were lodged near the castle around the mountain which it crowned, but those most trusted had their abode within the castle itself near the apartments of the princes. The docks were filled with triremes, three-decked vessels, and well-equipped with everything necessary to seafaring. On passing the gates of the outward zone, one came to a wall which commenced at the seashore and encircled the island and its zones for a distance of 9,000 feet until it joined the wall at the other side of the communicating canal. All the enclosed space was cultivated. The part which faced the sea was covered with villas and storehouses. The gulf was dotted with vessels, and the quays crowded with merchants from all parts who came and went within the port, making a continual clamor. Landward, the island presented a mountainous aspect, especially on that side of it which looks seaward. Around the royal city stretched a level plain, likewise circled by mountains except on the coast. The island looked southward. The most elevated sites were the only parts of it exposed to the ravages of the wind. Our mountains give only a feeble idea of the mountains of that island. Their majestic height, their continuous chain, the thick and tangled forests which covered them excited the liveliest admiration. Their slopes were covered with small towns, wealthy and populous and diversified by rivers, lakes, and prairies, furnished with abundant nourishment for an infinite number of wild beasts. In these forests, all kinds of useful woods were to be found. Talks about the 12 kings who was absolute on his own island. The ceremony of offering the bulls in sacrifice. The rule that none of these kings were permitted to take up arms against one another. That the children of Atlas were invariably given the leadership in all military expedition. And for many centuries they did not lose sight of their august origin. They obeyed all the laws and were religious adorers of the gods their ancestors. Then Zeus. Oh, wait a second. For many years they obeyed all the laws. And so long as they behaved in this manner, all was well with them. But in the course of time, the vicissitudes of human affairs corrupted little by little, and they began to comport themselves like the rest of the children of men. They hearkened to the promptings of ambition and sought to rule by violence. Then Zeus, the king of the gods, beholding this race, once so noble, growing depraved, resolved to punish it, and by sad experience to moderate its ambition. He convoked a council of the gods in Olympus and addressed them as follows. And here Plato's account ends. And it is believed that death interfered with its conclusion. Of course, the other record indicates that in one terrible, dreadful day, this great island of Atlantis sank into the sea. The Stones of Atlantis, Dr. David Zink. I born you? Late one evening in 1975, I sat by myself, lost in thought, in Brown's Bar on North Bimini Island. It was a sultry June night. The prevailing wind had died. Inside, under the air conditioning, Neville Brown tidied up the bar while watching television. The bar was quiet. Now, if you tuned in late, I got, first time in 58 years, muscle spasm in my upper back. I can't bend over. Come give me a cigar. Got to keep my brain warm. Am I boring you? Pretty good Tuesday night crowd. What'd you do, rob the other nights? I sure would like to keep teaching. And I can if you'll keep calling when the music plays. But right now, the bar was quiet because most of the island's visitors and the members of my expedition were elsewhere on the island dancing to live native music. How, I wondered, could an English professor like myself have gotten so far afield from Victorian literature as to pursue Atlantis as a serious archaeological possibility? It was one thing to teach Plato's myths to students of literature, and quite another to seriously contend that these tales may have contained some truth, that there may really have been an Atlantis. It's too hot in here. Obviously, I believe the latter, or I would not have embarked upon this expedition. A decade ago, few people, myself least of all, would have suggested that I would become involved in such a quest. To have anticipated several actual expeditions within the Bermuda Triangle would have been even more far-fetched. Under 17 feet of water, just 3 miles from where I sat in Brown's Bar, rested the mysterious stones which had once again brought me back to the Bahamas. I had returned for the second time, more convinced than ever that these huge encrusted limestone blocks, now covered with the sea for at least 6,000 years, might possibly hold the key to an important chapter in prehistory. Were they, as some people insisted, merely natural geological formations? Or could they be something altogether stranger and more significant? Perhaps even the remains of Atlantis or one of her colonies. I fervently hoped that the present expedition would penetrate the secrets of these cyclopean stones off Paradise Point. By now, whichever way it went, I wanted some answers. My background as an Air Force communications and electronics officer was hardly the expected beginning for a mission of this kind. Yet it was in the military service that I learned many of the skills and disciplines that later proved so valuable to my quest. As a commander of communications posts in Korea, I juggled responsibilities such as maintaining generator plants, road building, obtaining, sometimes by serendipity, necessary supplies, and supervising truck operations, all under extremely primitive conditions. After 4 years of this and other field assignments, my interest shifted from electronics to teaching, and I won a post at the new Air Force Academy in Denver, Colorado. Sent to graduate school to prepare for the assignment, I had the good luck to take a course under Professor Joseph Cohen, who founded the University Honors Program in the U.S. His seminar on philosophy and literature was a freewheeling head trip through the great themes of Western culture, drawing upon sciences as well as the arts to trace their origins. Once at the Academy, I was delighted to find an atmosphere of flexibility and innovation. The stereotypes about the, quote, military mind certainly did not apply to my fellow officers and faculty members, a lively, enthusiastic group. I was asked to teach a 2-semester humanities course structured around classics of Western literature. This course was designed to lure the cadets' attention from the more glamorous space age courses, so we in the English department worked hard to find the best titles and the most effective presentations. In our study of the Greek tragedies, we did everything possible to give students the feeling of the period. For example, our classes were assigned Robert Graves, the Greek myths, to provide them with the biological, anthropological, and political dimensions for the various myths on which dramas were based. This approach paid off as the cadets became intrigued with the classics and the course began filling up. My own students ranged to 4 in their reading, from Peter Tompkins' The Virgin and the Eunuch to Velikovsky's World and Collision. And Peter Tompkins also is the mystery of the pyramids. For both faculty and students, this cross-fertilization process greatly enlarged our intellectual horizons and introduced us to some of the surprising new theories about the prehistory of our planet. In the light of my rather conventional graduate education, I was at first inclined to dismiss these ideas as pretty far-fetched, but I eventually became fascinated enough with these theories to wonder just how far scholarly and scientific evidence might go towards supporting them. One of the most colorful of the new theorists was Emanuel Velikovsky, who observed that legends and myths around the world involve 7 destructions by fire and water. He proposed that these tales represented the residue of terrible natural violence actually endured by prehistoric man. He looked for and appeared to find scientific evidence for such catastrophes. As triggers to such violence, he particularly emphasized the close passage of Mars and Venus to the Earth. Although Velikovsky's theories were the target of much abuse for many years, a change in scientific attitude occurred in 1973 when he was invited to speak at Harvard. The following year... Oh, you want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
I don't think you do. Reading from the Stones of Atlantis by Dr. David Zink. As someone once said, the scholar's task is, quote, to find the truth no matter how obscure, to recognize it no matter in what strange form it may present itself, to formulate it honestly, to state it unmistakably, and to reason from it remorselessly and without regard to prejudice. And when you do that, if your experience is like my lifetime of study, God's Word comes out ahead. That's why we do it. Now, this is a very interesting book by a skeptic who became captured by the evidence for Atlantis. I think I want to take up right at this point tomorrow night.